First, I want to take this opportunity to thank the shul for hosting us and for everyone who joined, and the Avreichim for giving such an extra push energy. It always fascinates me in the area of business ethics to think that we can open sources that are so ancient, you know, thousands of years ago, and derive principles. You know, the Torah is called the Torah Chaim; it's a living Torah. And it's really quite powerful to see how you can open up. Sometimes you have a case which you think, I recently had an interesting case of someone who inherited books and he found money inside the books, and the question was, was this his or not? And it really came straight out of a Mishnah in Bava Metzia. A Mishnah I learned when I was in fourth grade, but who remembers what you learned in fourth grade, right? So today we want to cover a few possible, if we depending on time, if we get to cover these three topics, these three questions, and I hope you got a chance to take a look at them. The first question that we want to address deals with the case of lottery tickets. And this really reminds me of, in contemporary life, things like garage sales and all the rest. You know, you have people running around the earth and they pick up old things, old items, you know, ancient, what we call junk. I once tried to explain that in Hebrew. What is junk in Hebrew? I don't know. There's no real Hebrew word for junk. It's just sort of like a cultural word. You know, things that pile up in your garage, you know, for decades and decades. You know, people sell this stuff, and you know, there are other people who run around the whole world trying to buy these things, you know, never knowing what they might discover hidden behind, or maybe it's a special print or even a painting. And people will pay money for that. Of course, they usually get a good deal, and who knows what they might discover. So a lot of people, and maybe all of us in a sense, like to buy things that are risky on the chance that maybe it'll turn out to be valuable. And that's really what a lottery ticket is all about. You know, to buy a lottery ticket and hope that you can win. And in this case, just to go through the circumstances once again, as you've seen them on the page of Yirtzeh Hashem, the case is where Reuven has a bunch of lottery tickets to sell. He doesn't need all of them. He meets his friend Shimon. He thinks the lottery has not yet been drawn yet, so he sells Shimon a lottery ticket. And lo and behold, what he sold Shimon was the winning lottery ticket. So Shimon walks home with a beautiful new car, and Reuven has like a dollar in his pocket. You know, one of those loonies. So he's going loony from it. You know, he's saying, wait a minute, I didn't sell you a car, an automobile, a brand new, you know, Peugeot for a dollar. I want out, you know. And this raises the issue which is called in halakha mekach tos. You know, can I say that the sale was made under false premises? And therefore, there's no das. Now here we have to say a few words about das. Every kinyan requires das. In order to make a transaction, you have to be a willing, eager seller, or a willing, eager buyer. That's called das. For example, if somebody is forced to sell something under duress, then generally speaking, that sale is not valid, because it's lacking what? Das. It doesn't have das. Das means you have to have full agreement. We're learning Kiddushin this year. When you marry a woman, you have to have das. When she accepts the Kiddushin, she has to have das. Das is so fundamental to any kind of transaction in Jewish law that without it, the transaction is completely null and void. But what happens when you had das? You really made a decision. Nobody forced you at gunpoint to sell something. You did it out of the goodness of your heart with full agreement. But lo and behold, there were certain circumstances that you were unaware of. Could you have been aware of them? I don't know. That's an interesting question. Did the circumstances change subsequent to the sale? Or were the circumstances such that had you known, had you been aware at the time of the sale, you never would have entered into this agreement? And is it a mekach tos? That's going to be the first case that we want to discuss. But it's going to connect to another issue that has to do not with sale, but rather with gifts. And when would you say is the classical prime example of a gift, of a very dramatic kind of gift? What? A Yerusha. What would we call it in English? A will, right? You write away all your possessions to... So the Gemara has a case where a man writes all his possessions to some stranger because he's assuming that he has no children, no heirs, and lo and behold, he finds out that his wife is pregnant.
Or we find that even after his death. Can we null and void the will? And we're going to have an interesting case here with somebody, I don't know if you got a chance to see the second case on the bottom of page one, where somebody gave away all his possessions to someone who he thought was an absolutely good Samaritan. He was doing it out of the goodness of his heart, dedicated and devoted to serve this old man. And he finds out that's not exactly what the case was. He was missing certain circumstances that he wasn't aware of. And then finally, if you turn to page two, we have a question of a seller. You know, there are people who buy and sell things, and they don't always know exactly what schar or what they have. And they go ahead and they sell it, and then they find out that, oh no, I sold something of great value, and little did I know about it. These are all cases that are very deeply entrenched within the context of das, when a person didn't have das. And the classical case from the Gemara with chisaron das is the case in Bav Metzia, where I ask you to watch something, to guard it on my behalf, and you accept that responsibility. What's that called in halacha? When you accept responsibility to safeguard an object. Shomer, right? And if you're not paid for it, you're called a shomer chinam, which means you have the lowest level of responsibility. All you have to do is do the basic guarding, make sure that it's not exposed, otherwise you're negligent, which is called pshia, and you have to pay. And there was a case in the Gemara where Reuven said to Shimon, here, take this silver coin and guard it for me. And lo and behold, it was silver plated, but it was really a gold coin. And Shimon was very careless about guarding it, but little did he know that was what inside? It was gold. And the Gemara says, he accepted upon himself, Shmirah, to guard it for silver, but he never accepted upon himself the responsibility of gold. Which is the basis for that famous case, maybe you heard about it, of the Mexican coffee. You remember the case of the Mexican coffee? It was in all the papers. Yeah? Anybody? No, nobody read about this? This was an exciting case in Israel. It reached the Israeli press. What happened was, there were two friends, one was in New York, and his friend asked him, would you take Mexican coffee back to Israel for Nisim? We'll call him Nisim. Nisim is always a good name, right? And Nisim loves Mexican coffee. So the fellow says, for sure, wonderful. The only problem is he takes the Mexican coffee and he's sitting on the New York, I don't know if any of you have been to the New York subway system. It's not always, you know, the friendliest place to be. So anyway, he's sitting on a bench and he puts the coffee down on the bench and then he says, I'm going to go right across here to get a Coke in the kiosk. Well, what happens when he comes back? Sure enough, there's no coffee. Somebody took his Mexican coffee. And he is very upset because he realized that was a dumb thing on his behalf to put the coffee down sitting on. So what does he do? He has one day until his flight back to Israel. During that one, he dedicates an entire day to just scan the entire city of New York. Where can he buy this Mexican coffee? You can imagine how thrilled he was when he found the Mexican coffee. And he comes back, he calls up Nisim, he's got the phone number, Nisim comes immediately to pick up the coffee. And Nisim is thrilled, he walks out, 3 seconds later Nisim is banging on the door. He says to him, are you sure that this is the coffee you were asked to take to me? So he said, look, it's not exactly, but it's exactly the same coffee. I lost the coffee, but it turns out, of course, there were diamonds in the coffee. He wasn't sending a Mexican coffee. So he says, look, I took upon myself the responsibility of being careful with Mexican coffee. We all like Mexican coffee. I don't know anything about coffee, but I didn't take upon myself the responsibility for diamonds. That's already way beyond. So this came up in the courts, and the courts basically decided, based on a Gemara in Bav Metzia, it's amazing how they went back to the Gemara in Bav Metzia, and now in the Israeli court system, there's a member of the court that represents, it's already a tradition for quite a few decades, represent what's called the Mishpat HaEvri, which is the Hebrew law, and they went back to the ancient Jewish sources, and lo and behold, what do they find? This Gemara that I told you about, Bav Metzia. I took upon myself to watch something that's worth silver. I didn't know that it was gold, and therefore my responsibility goes up to the level of silver. The Gemara then says, but if you destroy the object, then you have to pay its full value. Because who asked you to destroy it? But in this case, he didn't destroy the Mexican coffee or the diamonds. He just let it there, and somebody, I guess somebody in New York is now very rich, probably passed it on to another few people. In the interim, what we come out with, and this is just in the interim, because I really want to get to the case of sales, because sales have their own rules and regulations, we find that Jewish morality puts a tremendous emphasis on das. What was the nature of my responsibility, what I accepted upon myself to be a shomer? And again, this goes into many different issues of responsibility and the extent of my responsibility. There was a famous case I wanted to tell you about. I don't know if you heard about this story. It took place about 150 years ago. My Rebbe's great-grandfather was the Beis HaLevi. You heard of the Beis HaLevi? Rabbi Yosher Ben Brisker. So there was a rabbinic convention. What happens? It was a decree by the Polish government outlawing chadarim, you know, for the young children to study in yeshiva. And the rabbis got together and they had to make a decision who would represent them to the Tsarist regime to present the case, you know, to defend the Jewish people. And there were two candidates. One candidate was an eloquent fellow, he's a businessman, he was known in the community. The other was a Talmid Chacham, he wasn't so eloquent, he wasn't so polished. And all the Rabbanim, Peh Echad, it was a unanimous decision, pointed their finger towards this businessman. This guy is eloquent, he will do a great job to protect our interests, to express our indignation against the government. And then the Beis HaLevi gets up at the meeting, he says, no. You don't understand. We have to send this Torah scholar. And why? Maybe he's not as eloquent. Maybe he's not as polished. But to him, the Torah is gold. To the other fellow, it's silver. This merchant will certainly respect the Torah, and he loves the Torah. But it's silver. It's an expensive metal. But he doesn't see it as gold. This is a very famous story that took place 150 years ago in Europe. Now, getting back to our case, what's your intuitive feeling? Oh, sorry, David. What's your intuitive feeling? What would you say about Reuven? He goes ahead and he sells a ticket, a lottery ticket. Little did he know, he was mistaken by about an hour. The lottery was already drawn. The ticket was the winning ticket. He sold the winning ticket to Shimon. Shimon is now a very happy, proud owner of a very, very fancy... What car should we call it?
Lamborghini.
A Lamborghini? Okay. I had a student once who knew every car inside. I could tell you every bolt and everything. He was into cars. If you're into cars, that's a big thing. All right. So Shimon is very happy. He's got the winning ticket. But Reuven says, that's not what I sold you. And Shimon says, look, you didn't know whether there was a lottery or there wasn't. I didn't know if there was a lottery. I bought it as a kind of, again, help me if the culture here is a little different than American culture, a jack-in-the-box. Does that mean anything here in Canada? Okay, good. I never know if my phrases are coming from a different culture. So, you buy a jack-in-the-box. So, what do you think? Can you help me out here? I mean, otherwise, I don't know if you're awake or not. But
it changed our opinion a little bit, but just off the bat, you know, it seems like, you know, it's buyer. The seller should have done his due diligence. He should have.
Excellent. So you're in favor of Shimon, correct? Shimon bought the lottery ticket. Reuven made a mistake. There was no due diligence on the part of the seller, and therefore the buyer wins. Anyone else want to defend the position that the buyer wins? I mean, he won the lottery, but that the sale is valid. Yeah. Joe, did you want to say something?
The seller.
You think the seller? You think it's a mekach tov?
In this situation, he sold it. He didn't. The lottery already happened.
Well, let me ask you a question. If I sell something and the situation has changed, and I didn't realize that, the situation as such would be that I wouldn't have entered into the sale. Then can I invalidate the sale?
That's what the Gemara
says. Which Gemara? Oh, here we get the Gemara. Where's the Gemara? Everybody has Gemara? I pasted it for you in the Aramaic. If you like, you could look at it in the English translation from the Art Scroll. And the Gemara goes into many, many details here about what happens in the case of a sale. And the motivation for the sale really was based on a mistake. For example, let's say I need money, I need cash. So I sell something in order to get the liquid funds so that I can buy something. I need to buy something. So I sell in order to buy. And lo and behold, the possibility of my buying something with that funds, with those funds that I get for selling, becomes completely impossible. For whatever reason, can I back out of the deal? So the Gemara begins with a story, if you'll take a look here in Ksuba's Daf, Sadi Zion, about a case that came in front of Rav Papa. Actually, Rav Papa was one of the litigants here in this case, because Rav Papa purchased land from a certain man who sold it to him because he needed money to buy Turei, to buy oxen. At the end, he didn't need the money, and Rav Papa returned the land to him. No, but we can't prove anything from Rav Papa. Why not? Because Rav Papa was a chassid. Maybe he went beyond the letter of the law. In truth, Rav Papa had legal rights to maintain his ownership, validate the sale, and tell the seller, look, okay, so you can't buy oxen. Tomorrow you'll buy oxen, or another time. The sale was valid. So the Gemara says maybe Rav Chisda went beyond the letter of the law. That's called Lifnim Mishuras Adin V'Asisa Yoshev HaTov. This, by the way, is a fascinating lesson to us, because whatever we address on a halachic legal level, we should always keep in mind that there's another dimension, and that is Lifnim Mishuras Adin. So even if we come to a conclusion that in a certain case you maybe you won't be able to invalidate the sale, but on the part of the buyer, there might be an extra motivation to go beyond the letter of the law and return it. So we always have to live in two dimensions. And I'll give you a very prime example of this. You should think about this. It's not for the Shia today, but something that you ought to think about. The Gemara has a concept called Gruma bin Ezekiel, which means I indirectly cause you damage. It wasn't an act of Hezek in which I destroyed something of yours, but nevertheless, had I been more careful, your object wouldn't have been destroyed. That's called Gruma. And the Gemara comes to the conclusion that in such a case, although technically I'm exempt, let's say the Gemara has a following case against, it's a wild case to think about, but a man, a mature individual, sends a child to damage something. Now technically, if you send a child, the child is not what's called a shliach, he's not an agent legally, and therefore whatever the child does, the one who sent him is completely exonerated. But yet the Gemara says, chayav bidin shamayim. So there are different levels here. There's Chayav B'din Adam, where you can be sued in a court of law and forced to pay. There's Chayav B'din Shamayim. Okay, we have to know exactly what that is. The Miri says it means that we can't force you to pay, but you really should pay, and you have to pay, and if you don't pay, you're a gazlan. And then there's this other level of Masisa Yashar Tov, of Lifnim Mishuras HaDin. Rav Papa returned it to the seller, even though he didn't have to do so. So you get the complexity of Jewish moral law. The Gemara goes on to bring another proof, in this case from Rav Nachman. What happened at the time of Rav Nachman? Why did people start selling their houses? Anybody remember? There was a drought, correct? There was a famine in the land, in Narda. Okay, Narda is a famous city in Babel, where there was a lot of Torah scholarship. So why were people willing to sell their homes, the roof over their heads, for a very reasonable price, meaning really undermine the price, because they desperately needed to buy wheat, and the price of wheat skyrocketed. Now they find out that the ships were coming. Why didn't the ships dock with all the wheat, volumes and volumes of wheat? All of a sudden, the price of wheat plummeted. They didn't know about it, because they didn't have fax machines, and they didn't have cellular phones in those days. So communication was very limited. The ships were about to dock. It took them a little extra time because the waters, the tides were very high. But right there, the ships are a few feet away from docking, bringing volumes of wheat. Automatically, the price of wheat is going to go down. So the case came in front of Rav Nachman. Is that not so? Take a look at your page, if you can. Amalu Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman told the buyers, who are now proud owners of all these beautiful homes, Dinahu dehadri Afande Lamarayu, according to the technical law, that all these sales are invalid. And the Gemara says, why are they invalid? Because they were sold, the sale was done under false assumptions. The premise was that the price of wheat is up. In truth, already, excuse me, at that moment in time, everything was set in motion so that the price of wheat would go down. The sellers were not aware of it, and therefore they can invalidate the sale. Is that the same as our case of Reuven selling a lottery ticket?
No.
Why is a lottery ticket so different than a classical sale? Anybody?
Double? It's a risk by definition.
Correct. If it's a risk by definition, if the sale in its very nature is jack in the box, I'm telling you, I don't know what's behind this door. Do you remember there used to be a television program? What was it called?
Price is Right.
The Price is Right, yeah. And you can try to guess what's behind the door, and you offer a price. Let's look at this from Shimon's perspective. Shimon bought a lottery ticket. The chances of his winning the ticket, whether in the future or in the past, statistically don't change. And it's a very small percentage of probability that he actually is holding on to what will be, already was, the winning ticket. So Shimon basically is saying to Reuven, look, you and I don't know what the real value of this ticket is, but we all can assume, according to the game of statistics, that it's not worth that much. Let's make an agreement. How much do you want for the ticket? You want to sell it to me for a dollar? I'll pay you a dollar for it. A sale is an agreement between both buyer and seller, the Machna and the Kona. The Machna and the Kona in this case agreed that the nature of this lottery ticket is unknown. Just similar to the case where I sell you an old print or an old painting or any other sort of old junk, and that's the nature of a garage sale. So although the case that we're addressing sounds awfully similar to that of selling one's home, thinking that the price of wheat is high when in truth it's low, yesh lechalek, you could make a distinction. In the case of a home, you know, in a case of wheat, I mean, these are things that should have a definite price tag. But you have some things which by definition, the nature of the object is such as a built-in risk. And there you cannot put your finger on the price and say, well, this is what it's worth. So far, so good. Again, we're basically, to summarize what we're saying here, in the case of the lottery ticket, we're not sure that the case in the Gemara in Ksuvos, the classical case of Mekach Tos, would apply to a lottery ticket. A lottery ticket might be a very unique kind of sale where both buyer and seller are in agreement that it's so iffy that no backs touch blacks. You know, this is the agreement. You know, we agree, I'm going to pay you, I'm taking that risk.
But isn't that true of commodities as well? Commodities?
Well, I assume that commodities have a certain level of fluctuation, but how much fluctuation do they have? Is it between a dollar and $1 million? You know what I mean? Or is it, you know, it goes up, it goes down. So for example, what happens if I sell you something and you could prove in front of a court of law that I overcharged you? What's that called in halacha? Oh no! If I overcharged you, can you claim A, I want to back out of the deal, or at least B, give me back the differential? There was a discrepancy between what I paid and what the market value is.
But in both cases here, the DOS is the same on the buyer and the seller. Nobody knows the value of the wheat's about to change, either the buyer or the seller. Is that correct?
I would assume. Yeah, nobody's cheating anyone, if that's what you mean. There wasn't a deliberate act of fraud, but the question is, do you have a right to say, well, that's not the price that it's worth? So again, if the nature of the agreement was such that we spoke this all out. We said, look, we don't know what it's worth. You're willing to take the risk. You pay a very low price, and that's what I'm going to sell it to you for. That's one case. Another case is where I'm selling you a commodity on the market as a definite, within a certain range, a definite price tag, you know, based on the market conditions. There may be some fluctuation. There may be some room for error. The Gemara says in Onah, up to a shtus, up to 1/6. You, the seller, or the buyer, depending on whether he's overcharged or undercharged, have no claim whatsoever. If it's more than a shtus, then you, who suffered do I overpay? Or, in the case of Lokech, do I underpay? You have a right to say, I want out of this deal.
This
in the case of a shtus, if it's exactly 1/6, then I could get my discrepancy, the discrepancy back.
The market value is changing dramatically, very suddenly. It's not as though that's the price you're overcharging for it. The actual market value of the wheat changed in the blink of an eye. Right?
Correct.
It's not that you had wheat that was not valuable, but you overcharged the guy for it. It was very valuable.
Again, David, I don't think the main thrust of our point here is that the value of the wheat went up and down. You know, I think the main point here is, did I really want to sell you my house? Did I want to end up with a situation that I don't have a roof over my head? And the answer is, it depends. So the value of the wheat is a secondary factor, but the main thrust and the primary idea that we're trying to convey here is that the sale itself was done under false premises. That's called the mekatos. The question is, in the lottery ticket, can you say, well, the sale was done under false premises? Yeah.
I think another way you can look at the lottery ticket, just to kind of see whether it was done under false premises, if Reuben had sold Shimon a losing lottery ticket for $5, and Shimon would have taken on that $5 worth of risk that I might win, I might not win, would Reuben have the responsibility of buying back, giving Shimon back his $5 if he lost?
And what's the obvious answer?
In fact, we would think no, because I mean he had taken on that risk. He knew what the risk was. But then on the other hand, he should be able to, you know, gain the benefits of that risk. If
that's why I say that it's the card goes both ways. You know, it could go in the favor of the buyer, it could go in favor of the seller. That's the nature of a risk, and we don't know. But imagine if we're going to go run around invalidating all sorts of sales and transactions because somebody bought something at a risk, and lo and behold, he hit the jackpot. You know, he found a treasure, a hidden treasure. So we're going to start invalidating all those sales. I don't know. But again, at the surface of it, you could see why some of the poskim quote this Gemara in Ksuvis as a proof to establish mekatos. But let's go on to the second case. The elderly gentleman. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, so I see the differentiation somewhat different. So the point there before was that the lottery, by definition, is a risk, right? So then the buyer and seller know exactly what they're getting into. Here, the seller is arguing that because the lottery took place after he sold it, and before he sold the ticket,
correct,
it's a different situation. And so he's trying to argue this, that it was a different context. But I think that doesn't work, because even had he known, I think he's just being selective in his argument, but even had they both known, they could have still gone ahead with the transaction.
Absolutely. So I agree with you 1,000%. The changes in the statistical probability of whether it was a winning ticket or will be a winning ticket are nil. There's absolutely no difference. You see, if you're telling me that the price of wheat went down and then I sold it to you not knowing that, you know, that's something to argue. But to say that, you know, the lottery was already drawn, what difference makes? Shimon would have said to him, look, I'm going to buy this lottery ticket, whether it will win, whether it won't win, whether it won or it didn't win. All the possibilities are on the table. I think the sale would have been exactly the same. Wouldn't Reuven have said to Shimon, look, yesterday was the lottery. I have no clue, in all honesty, you're a good buddy of mine. I'm being straight up with you. I have no clue if what I'm selling you is the winning ticket or not. It's the same exact percentage. I don't see, in my mind, the difference. So if there's such a thing as an agreement between a buyer and a seller on a risk sale, I don't know that the seller could say, well, what was hidden behind the frame, you know, was the signature of when Renoir, this is an original Renoir, which sells for $1.5 million, you know, and therefore the sale is, I don't think so. You sold it and that's, you gotta swallow the pill. What about in the case of Moshe? Here we get back to the inheritance. Now I'm trying to fit in a lot in the next few minutes. Moshe thinks that this man has been working for him out of self-devotion, out of love, taking care of his needs for 3 years, writes a will, and he cuts out his son, who picked up and left to Chutz Laretz, and bequeaths his entire $2 million. Did you get the sum there? If you didn't take a look at it, it's pretty amazing. And this also became a very famous case in Eretz Yisrael. $2 million he gives over to this fellow who was taking care of him. Very common kind of psychological situation where you think your children left you alone, you know, you're forlorn, they nitchuotcha, you know, they left you all on your own. And the father was very upset about this, and the son, despite all the imploring of his father, he just packed out. Meanwhile, little did he know that this guy wasn't such a self-motivated, great devotionist and, you know, take care of old people guy, kind of guy. I'm not taking away whatever schar will get, I don't know. That's between him and the Ribbono Shel Olam, but certainly Reb Moshe Olav Shalom, you know, was unaware of the facts. Would he have cut out his son knowing that his son organized this thing and was paying a monthly salary to make sure that so-and-so would take care of his father? He just told him, don't tell my father. And the reason, why do you think he told him, don't disclose the secret? Can you guess? The father felt much more comfortable thinking that he had a personal relationship with someone who was taking care, tending to his needs, not because he was a professional. You know, people, this is a common psychological phenomenon, that when people are serviced by professionals, it's a whole different kind of relationship. They don't feel special. They don't feel that anyone is taking particular care of them, expressing their love to them in any way. They're simply being paid for it. And I think here, if you take a look in the Shulchan Aruch, and this is on page 2, I'll translate it for you because I don't have any text with the translation. Li'olam omdin das hanosen. In the laws of matana of gifts, and here we're talking about a substantial gift, then we have to do what's called omed. Omed means we have to evaluate what was his mental state. Im hayu advarim marim sof daito, if we have indications what really was motivating him when he gave away this gift, osim al pi omed, then halacha works through umdina. A person, when he gives a gift, and certainly a last will or testament, he doesn't have to sign any sort of tnai, what's called an official condition that has to be written out with all the laws of conditions. It's afal pishlo pirech. She doesn't have to spell it out. Ketzad. And the Shulchan Aruch gives a case which is so similar to our case. Mishalach b'no l'medina sayam. He thinks he has no heirs. His son went off on a long trip to China. And the rumor comes back that he unfortunately didn't survive. So Kasav kol nechasav li'acher, he offers all his possessions as a gift. Matana gluya gmura, it's an open gift, nobody can contest it. He did it midas, he wasn't forced. V'acher kach bo b'no, his son comes back, he's alive and well on 2 feet. Ein matnoso kayemes, such a gift is invalid. Unless he divvied up his possessions in such a way that he gave a due amount to his children and he gave to this fellow because he felt... That's one thing, but imagine to cut out one of your Yarshin, or all of your Yarshin, either because you think they perished, they're not alive. Like I mentioned the case before of a man who thought his wife was not pregnant and he gave away all his possessions to some alien, some stranger, and he finds out that his wife is pregnant. Or in this case where a man gave away all his possessions to some individual, not knowing that his son was not only alive, just physically, but it was alive spiritually. And he was really behind this whole situation in order to do the best he could for his father. And here I want to call to your attention a very interesting comment to the Ramah in Hilchas Talmud Torah. And this will be in the middle of your page 2. The law is that a person owes respect to both his father in this case and his Rebbe. Now, would there be a choice situation between father and Rebbe, and you can't do both, or at least you have to set up a priority, a sequence? Who comes first? This is a Mishnah above Mitzvah. Anybody remember this? Your Rebbe comes first because he brings you to Olam Haba. And the Rambam wants to know what happens to the Rebbe who has been teaching you for years, but he's being paid. And who's signing the checks? Who's paying his salary? Your father. Says the Rambam, in such case, your father comes first. What it really means is that, halachically, we don't have the same debt of gratitude to someone who's being paid for his work. You know, this is the old question about chaplains in hospitals. You know, a chaplain comes to visit a patient. And the question is, that's a great chesed, you know, to bring a smile on the face of a patient who's never been in the hospital, in a hospital bed. Does he get reward? So if he's being paid for it, If he's getting a salary, he's a professional, then, again, I'm not going into halacha l'maaseh, but in theory, he forfeits a lot of his reward. So the poskim say, in order to avoid this situation, what you do is you sit down next to the chole, you know, give him some extra time. According to contract, he's not obligated. He goes above and beyond. Then he gets reward, not only in this world, he'll get a salary check, but he'll also get reward in the next. And this is true in so many areas of life. Whenever you're in a field related to services, or even if not, even if you're a professional, there's so many opportunities to do chesed. If you're going beyond what you're paid for, the contract agreement, you'll get schar for that. I was always wondering, you get on a bus. I don't know how many of you use buses here in Toronto. How many? Okay, we get two hands up. Okay, good. All right, I guess... So the question is, there's a mitzvah, one of the 613 is paying schar sochir. If somebody does a service to you and you pay him, the actual payment is a mitzvah. But who keeps this in mind? You know, we just put the money in. But imagine if you'd say hello to the to the driver. You gotta make him feel good. If you add something to an act of payment, then the increment is something that generates reward. In this case, to say that he would cut out his whole... To me, this is... an open and shut case. And finally, the third case, because I want to get back to the lottery, because the third case I think is going to shed some light on the lottery ticket. This is a case of someone who buys and sells books. What would you call that? A wholesaler? So did I get that right? In Hebrew, it's called what was the language that the post used? Sarsur. Sarsur is this in-between man. You know, you have stuff to buy, you have stuff to sell, he wants to buy, I'm the middleman, right?
A broker.
Okay, Sarsur is a broker. Excellent. Now, the broker may or not be aware of what he bought. Yeah, he's handling, he's doing so much business, buying and selling, he doesn't always take the time to check out the schorah and see what is its true value. He's dealing in large volumes and so forth and so on. So in this case, a very experienced antique book collector or bookseller comes into this store and the broker sells him a sefer. And lo and behold, before the sale is clinched, this potential buyer, as I said, he has a great eye for evaluating old books. He notices, there's a very famous case that came up in Israel, that on one of the pages there's a few words with a signature attached, handwritten from none other than the Chidah. The Chidah who lived at the end of the 1700s, who, I can't begin to tell you in certain circles, maybe more amongst Sfaradim than Ashkenazim, but even amongst Ashkenazim, I mean, you hear the name Chidah, you start shaking. His last name was Azulai. Every city in Israel has at least one street named after him, the Chidah. He was an unbelievably prolific writer. He wrote hundreds of Sfarim. And imagine owning a sefer that has his signature on it. The guy buys the sefer for what would have been the normal price without the signature of the Chidah, an inexpensive price, and puts it up on the market the very next day. The rumor spreads like it's got wings. Everybody hears there's a sefer up for sale with a handwritten signature of the Chidah. Something that comes up once every... couple of hundred years. You know what I mean? It's really rare. So of course the seller finds out about this. This broker who sold him the thing, and he wants out. He wants to claim. I never... So there's an interesting halacha here, which I want to call to your attention, of a sarsur.
Is there an issue of Gonev Das?
Maybe. That might also come in. But the only problem is, Gonev Das applies if I know that this is yours, and I deliberately buy it at a cheap price.
That's what he seems to be doing, because he's bound.
Oh, so here, Jeff, listen to Chiddush. This will boggle your mind. This is where Jewish moral business ethics is radically different than what we're used to. The Ramah says, and it's based on a Mardechai, that there's a special halacha that applies to a sarsur, to a broker. A broker only owns what is obvious, what he sees with his eye. If there's something above and beyond that, he's just the middleman, he never really acquires ownership on it. Take a look, it's a fascinating concept. Im kana hasarsur dover b'cheskas b'dil u'macharo. B'dil is like a tin. So he buys something that looks like tin, and he sells it. Achkas no the shoyibo kesef o zahav. There was gold or silver. It's on the bottom of your page two. Zach alokeach. The broker cannot undermine the sale and say, look, had I known that underneath the tin there was silver or gold, I never would have sold it to you. There's a special, how should I say, status, halachically, in business ethics, in Jewish business ethics, of a broker. That a broker is just interested in buying and selling if the object is worth, because of some secret treasure, much, much more than what he paid for it, then he never really acquires that. He has no ownership. Now again, if the original owner would come by and make a claim, that's a different story. But we only have two litigants in front of us. We've got this broker and we got the buyer. The buyer says, I got a book that has the signature of the Chidor on it. You're buying and selling books, I got it. The broker says, I never would have sold it to you. So the law rules in favor of the buyer in this case. The seller, who's the broker, is the sarsur, has no claim to Mekach Tos. And then I saw in a sefer called Shevet HaLevi from Rav Vosner, one of the poskim of that time, and he wants to say the following, that the case of the Mardechai, which is quoted here in the Ramah, is very unique. What's special about it? Because a tin utensil is not the same as silver and gold that's surrounded by tin. There are two different objects here. When the broker purchased the object, he purchased object A and not object B. So therefore object B was never his. He never acquired ownership on it. And therefore when he sells it, he wasn't really the seller at all. And the new owner who purchased it is the proud owner of this gold and silver. Says Rav Vosner, but not so in the case of a sefer, of a book. Whether the book has the signature of the Chidah on it or doesn't, it still is the same identical object. The identity of the object has not changed. And therefore the broker acquired ownership not just on the book, but on the signature of the Chidah as well. If unbeknown to him, he sold it at a cheap price, he can claim Mekach Tos. So what we see over here is that we have to define the object. Is it the same object or is it a different object? That's called Shinui Zehus HaChefetz, the difference in the identity of the object. Now if this be the case, when I go back to the lottery ticket, I have to ask myself the following. Is there a difference between a lottery ticket that won and a lottery ticket that didn't win? And what would be your answer to that? I mean, just shoot from the hip. Yes, it's a whole different identity. So therefore I don't know if the seller ever actually owned that discrepancy between a piece of paper which has a lottery number on it and its true value. Now you have to ask yourself the following question. Does Reuven, who sells lottery tickets, does he have the status as a sarsur, as a broker, or is he just a regular mocher, like the case of someone who sold the roof over his head, not knowing that the price of wheat had dropped or was about to drop, and therefore he could claim Mekach Tos. So let's just summarize what we've seen today. Okay? And then I'll let you go. The topic for today was business ethics, was specifically deals that were made, that were clinched under lack of das, under false premises. We basically addressed three different cases, but they're more than three, actually. They're three, but they're really probably six. But in any event, the first case is where I sell you something not knowing its true value. Had I known its true value, I wouldn't have sold it to you. And there we seem to think that maybe with the exception of a built-in jack-in-the-box risk kind of situation, then I have a right to back out of the deal, null the sale, void it because I didn't know there was a chisaron das, there's no das mak. Case number two, Yerusha or Matana, where I gave away and cut out my children, that's invalid because had I known, I never would have given it away. I was lacking in das. In the third case, however, the case of the broker, then the halacha seems to hinge on one and only one question. When the broker purchased something, and now we find out that it was worth a great deal more, is that increment in value indicative? An expression of the fact that it's a different object entirely? You cannot compare bedil to Zahav. Bedil and Zahav are two different commodities. And therefore the broker never owned the gold. He only owned the tin. And therefore the lokeach has rights to pocket it because the broker can't say, I want it back. The broker never owned it to begin with. Then we came back to the case of the lottery ticket. We were wondering if a lottery ticket is a different object. And the question is, what did he sell? And what did he own to sell? What did Reuven sell? The question is where to place that. Should we subsume it under the classical case of Mechira, and therefore we say it was a toast? Can we put it under the special case of an agreement between the buyer and the seller that despite the fact that it may be worth one, we're both accepting the sale at that price, it's a risk situation? Can we perhaps compare it to the Sarsour case and claim that Reuven really never ever gained that extra value on the ticket, and therefore when he sold it, It belongs to Shimon. I want to again take this opportunity to thank everyone for coming, and we should be zocher really to learn Hashem's Torah and see amazing things, how questions that come up in actual contemporary society can be connected to the ancient sources of our Torah, and then we should be zocher to leave the Torah on the highest level. Kedi Ratzon. Amen.